From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Tiger's a familiar sight on the tee, on the television, in the testimonials, and now he's in the tabloids. Ahead on Only a Game, a tiny bit of Tiger, but not too much. Also, a 2010 World Cup draw wrap-up, Cleveland's Dog Pound calls out the Browns, and a conversation with Tom Krattenmaker, author of Onward Christian Athletes, Turning Ballparks into Pulpits and Players into Preachers. Also ahead, the University of Cincinnati football team makes an honorary Bearcat of a 12-year-old recovering from brain cancer.
I thought it was kind of overwhelming to see all those guys clapping and giving me a standing ovation. And it made me proud that they're adopting me and accepting me into their family.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. As an estimated almost everybody in the world, except for a lot of people in the United States, looked on, yesterday it was determined which teams would play each other when soccer's World Cup gets underway in South Africa in June. I'm joined now by Sports Illustrated's Grant Wall, who's in Uruguay on vacation, but agreed to speak to me anyway. Thank you, Grant.
Thanks for having me.
The U.S. will open the tournament by playing England on June 12th. Are you looking forward to seeing David Beckham and Landon Donovan on opposite sides?
I can't imagine how much hype there's going to be for this game, both in the U.S. and in England. To have Donovan and Beckham, teammates on the Los Angeles Galaxy, going against each other will certainly give us plenty to talk about heading into the game. And you could argue that England has more followers inside the United States than any other national team besides the U.S. So I think this is a perfect matchup for the U.S., a glitzy one. It's going to be tough because England has been playing very well the last couple of years under Fabio Capello, their Italian coach. But it's also a chance for the U.S. to pull off an upset, kind of like the one in 1950 when the U.S. beat England 1-0 the last time these two teams played in the World Cup.
Do you see both the U.S. and England getting through, or do either of the other two teams in Group C, Algeria and Slovenia, play better than their ranking and prevail?
I see the U.S. and England getting through. I think it's a really good draw for the U.S., and most people will pick the U.S. to advance. Algeria and Slovenia are decent teams, but they're arguably the worst teams in Africa and Europe to qualify for this World Cup. So I don't think the U.S. could have asked for much more in this draw.
France needed luck to get to the tournament. They beat Ireland on a goal scored after an obvious handball. Is it fair to say the French got some luck in the draw as well?
Oh, sure. South Africa was the only one of the eight seeded teams that didn't really earn it in each of the groups. The host team automatically gets a top seed, and so France doesn't have to face any of the other world powers in their group, which they would have had to do if they'd gotten seven of the other eight groups as their draw. So I think it's a very good draw for France, which is has been awfully lucky lately, obviously, to get the call that allowed them to go through to the World Cup against Ireland. And now with this draw and having to play South Africa, which, to be honest, is a very poor team.
You're in Uruguay as we speak. I would imagine folks there have to feel fortunate to have been drawn into the group with South Africa, though it does also include France and Mexico.
Yeah, I think people here seem pretty easygoing about the whole thing. Maybe that's just the way they are here in Uruguay. But Uruguay is a team that's won two World Cups, if you could believe it, back in 1930 and 1950. And it's going to be an interesting group because Mexico is a team that travels well, actually. And I actually have France and Mexico getting out of this group, but I think it's going to be pretty competitive.
Grant, it is customary to identify one aggregation as the so-called group of death. This time around, I assume that would be Group G, which includes Brazil, number two in the world, Portugal, number five in the world, and the very unfortunate teams from North Korea and Ivory Coast.
I think if there's one group of death, this is it. I don't think this is as bad as some of the ones we've seen over the years, just because North Korea is a very poor team that hasn't been to World Cup since 1966. But it's too bad that one of Brazil, Ivory Coast, or Portugal won't survive the opening round, because all three could go deep in this tournament. Portugal has the reigning World Player of the Year, Cristiano Ronaldo. Ivory Coast has a ton of good European players like Didier Drogba on the team, and they're kind of a sexy sleeper pick to go deep in the World Cup. And Brazil is Brazil. So one of those teams isn't going to make it. I think Ivory Coast is going to get through with Brazil at Portugal's expense, and it should be a fun group to watch.
As you look at the other groups, what particularly intriguing first-round matchups occur to you?
Well, if you look at the rest of the groups, it's interesting because a lot of the top teams like Italy and Spain all got very favorable draws, very little competition, I think, in the rest of those groups. One interesting group to me is the one that has Germany in it, but also Australia, Serbia, and Ghana. And Germany's the best team in that group, but the other three are all very good teams that have the talent to advance, and I think it's going to be a very balanced group. And then you look at Group B, and Argentina is a team that has perhaps the most talent in the world, but is led by Diego Maradona, who is a terrible coach, unfortunately, after being such a great player in his day. Argentina's with Nigeria, South Korea, and Greece. I think Argentina will get through, but of all the top seeds, I actually think that Argentina has the most likely chance not to get through.
Grant, in past World Cups, there has often been an underdog so unlikely that we might even call it an underpuppy. Can you find one for us somewhere in this World Cup?
Well, my Cinderella team comes from the United States' region, and that's Honduras, which is a team that plays attacking soccer. They're very athletic, too, unlike a lot of the other Central American teams, and I think they've got a good draw here. Spain is in their group and should win the group, but Switzerland and Chile are okay teams, but I think teams that Honduras could surprise and get out and make a run and really turn some heads globally.
Grant Wall writes about soccer for Sports Illustrated and SI.com. He joined me from Uruguay, where he is on vacation. Again, thank you, Grant.
Back to the beach. Thanks, Bill.
How bad does a team have to get before fans completely lose interest? That's the question in Cleveland, Ohio, where football is still king, if only barely, but the Browns are the court jester. Being bad is nothing new for the 1-10 Browns, but this year they may reach new lows. Tomorrow's game against the San Diego Chargers was nearly blacked out, saving the Browns' decade-long home sellout streak from an ignominious end. From member station WCPN in Cleveland, Eric Wellman reports.
Think about the worst movie you've ever seen. You wouldn't stand in line for 12 hours to see the sequel, would you? Well, Cleveland Browns fans might. They are fiercely passionate about a very bad team, and they have been for a long time. Go down to the municipal parking lot next to Browns Stadium at 7 o'clock in the morning for a 1 o'clock game, and the place is already packed with tailgaters, like Tony Schaefer.
All over the NFL, I've not seen anybody tailgate like Cleveland.
Today's Browns have nothing in common with the Browns of the 1960s, who at that time were the team to beat. This squad is an expansion team that came to Cleveland in 1999 and adopted the old name. That's when Tony Schaefer bought a school bus, painted it black and orange, and turned it into the ultimate tailgating machine. He calls himself Mobile Dog.
What we did with this bus, we took a bunch of seats out, we put a bed in, we put a toilet in, and then I have a refrigerator in here.
And Schaefer's not the only one. Over a dozen buses dot the Muni lot on a typical game day. Looking at their fans, you would never know the Browns have one of the NFL's worst teams this decade. This season, under new head coach Eric Mangini, they've reached a new low. With only one win and 10 losses, they have a shot at breaking several unenviable records, including fewest points scored in a season ever. When they lose big, often by double-digit margins. Matt Lodi is the Browns beat reporter for Fox Sports Radio.
You know, what's going on right now is an absolute abomination of what this city represents for this football team, because this city represents this football team like no other city I've ever even been to.
I'm very frustrated. I'm disgusted.
That's longtime Browns fan Deborah Darnell.
I have to tell you, this is the worst football I've ever watched in my life. And I'm a huge football fan. Huge.
Darnell is no ordinary fan. Clevelanders know her as the Bone Lady, and she drives a special car.
Okay, I didn't clean it out for you, Eric.
Darnell makes her living as an artist. She painted her car to look like a Browns helmet with a giant bone on top that runs the length of the vehicle. And she designed a hat that looks like a beehive that's comprised of Brown's paraphernalia.
I always say, Bone Ladies, what happens when you drink too much beer and you own a glue gun?
She says, sadly, tailgating has become the highlight of the game day experience because there's so little to cheer for on the field.
If Woodstock and Mardi Gras were all rolled up into one, that would be tailgating in the Muni lot. And it's sad because a lot of us have sort of, we just so want to see good football in this town.
And for Browns fans, it's been a long time. Jim Brown, who played for Cleveland when they won the championship in 1964, continues to be a household name in Cleveland. These days, the casual fan is hard-pressed to name more than three players on the current team. And now there's a growing sense that people are beginning to get fed up. After more than 10 years of consecutive sellouts, the unthinkable has happened. People stop buying tickets, and there's anecdotal evidence that some fans won't be coming back next year.
Oh, there's thousands and thousands of people that are not renewing their season tickets. They're done.
Mike Randall is known in Cleveland as Dog Pound Mike. He sits in the front row, dressed up as, well, a dog. Earlier this season, he gained notoriety when he staged an unsuccessful protest by encouraging fans to sit out the beginning of a nationally televised game. The empty seats he hoped the cameras would see never materialized. But he did get the attention of the Browns owner, Randy Lerner, who agreed to meet with him. Their scheduled 30-minute meeting went on for 2 hours.
The meeting with Randy Lerner was great. And I told him, I said, Randy, listen, you have an issue. And a lot of people in your organization are not really telling you what you need to know.
And what Randy Lerner needs to understand is that this city needs to get excited about its football team again.
Again, reporter Matt Lodi.
And the way that that has to go is you have to go out there and you have to find a general manager and a coach that's going to come in and make things happen.
General manager George Kokinas was fired mid-season. It's all but certain coach Eric Mangini will soon have the same fate. Lodi says when he visits the team's locker room, he is struck by the players' lack of direction.
I don't not see passion. I don't want to paint this picture that this team doesn't care. That's the problem, is the team cares, but there's just no leadership, it feels like.
Most Browns fans believe the team has reached such a low point that it will be years before things get any better. Deborah Darnell, the Bone Lady, says she just wants a team that's not an embarrassment.
I'm to a point now where I have lowered my standards. Like, we don't have to win. Just, I want to watch a game. I want to watch professional football.
On Sunday, the Browns take the field against the San Diego Chargers. In Cleveland, people don't say this out loud, but many are thinking it. They want their team to lose the rest of the season. That way, Coach Eric Mangini will be fired, and the Browns will secure a better spot in the draft. Sad, huh? For Only a Game, I'm Eric Wellman in Cleveland.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Jeff Berger and millions of other American men stretched out on their respective couches on Sunday to watch football. But among those millions of men, only Jeff Berger had to deal with a deer that came crashing through his window and leapt on to the couch. It would be cool if Berger had shouted, "Oh dear," but he didn't. He got up and ran, and then he called the police, who obligingly chased the deer out from behind the couch and into some nearby woods, where the reception was probably bad, since why else would the deer have come into Mr. Berger's place to watch the game? I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, Praise the Lord and Pass the Football. But first, Tiger Woods may well be the greatest golfer ever, and that may be, to paraphrase John Keats, all we know and all we need to know. But for better or for worse, we know more. That is the nature of our culture, in which anything done by those who are very wealthy or very famous or both attracts attention, even if the anything has nothing to do with what has enabled the very wealthy or very famous to achieve those distinctions. By being a superb golfer and a ubiquitous representative of all manner of corporate interests and products, Tiger Woods became rich and famous. The trade-off, whether he or we like it or not, is that in the process he has created the illusion that he has become ours. He can't blame the public for that development, since he and his handlers have been carefully but constantly courting that public for more than a decade. So we know that Tiger Woods drove his SUV into a fire hydrant and a tree a little over a week ago, and that the SUV acquired a broken window. We know, as of yesterday, that neighbors found Tiger Woods barefoot and snoring beside his vehicle shortly after the crash, which is odd. We know that simultaneous with the accident, tales of various dalliances began to appear, first in the tabloids and their electronic equivalent, and then in the sports pages. We know that Tiger Woods decided that the best way to respond to those tales was to post on his website a general statement of remorse and apology. How all this, whatever it turns out to be, will impact the golf career and personal life of Tiger Woods remains to be seen. But we need to turn now to the story of another prominent golfer who'd like to keep various matters private, especially such matters as his handicap. President Barack Obama's passion for basketball is well known, but Mr. Obama also plays golf, sort of. Wall Street Journal reporter Elizabeth Williamson's article about Mr. Obama's efforts as the first duffer is titled, Quietly, the President Finds That Golf is No Slam Dunk, and she joins me now on the line. Welcome to Only a Game.
Bill, it's my pleasure to be with you.
When did President Obama start playing the game of golf, and how often does he get to play?
He started playing about 10, 12 years ago when he was still a state senator, practicing and getting out on the links when he was in Springfield.
And how often now does he get out there now that he's president?
Well, when the weather's good, as it has generally been, he's usually out almost every weekend that he's in Washington. And when he was on vacation at the end of August in Martha's Vineyard, he was out almost every day during that week.
It's easy to find pictures and video of the president playing basketball, but it's more difficult to see evidence of his golf skills. How much effort is President Obama making to keep his swing out of the public eye?
It appears to be a pretty substantial effort, not only by himself, but by his aides. So his score, according to David Axelrod, his political advisor, is a matter of national security. He travels with a pretty significant security detail. Secret Service accompanies him onto the course. And those who have golfed or coached other presidents say that it is probably twice the size of the security detail of any other presidential golfer.
Despite the efforts to keep the president's game a secret, you did find some firsthand accounts of his skills, I understand. Tell us about some of the comments from other golfers.
I had heard that when he was president-elect back in December, there was some footage still available on the internet of him golfing in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And someone told me that you could actually hear people laughing in the background. So I thought, this could be a clue as to his skill level. So I circled back to some of the folks. I was with the president on Martha's Vineyard this summer, and I circled back to some of the pros at the golf clubs where he had golfed during that time. And now these guys are wintering down in Florida, and they're off the reservation, as it were, so they were more willing to talk to me. For example, one is Gene Mulak, who is at the Vineyard Golf Club on Martha's Vineyard, and he was saying that he helped the president out of a sand trap. And they have, on that course, I recall, they have really difficult sand traps. And he was saying, no, the technique that he was using, he wouldn't have gotten out of any sand trap in the country. You know, when he passed by, he saw the president trying to whack his way out of the sand trap and just sort of offered him some advice, sort of shouting from afar, open the club face more. And that brought him to the attention of the Secret Service. But still, the president waved him over, and he gave him some lessons in trying to escape from there. But I asked him, you know, well, did you want to give him a lesson? He said, no, I was hoping that I could just sort of avoid that because I'm not an ambulance chaser.
Some golfers who are just starting out, and many who have played for years, take wide liberties with the rules of the game. Former President Bill Clinton was notorious for his liberal, so to speak, use of mulligans, or do-overs, as some of the rest of us call them. But you found that the current president is more of a stickler.
It is interesting how, especially when we're talking about the presidents, how the golfing skills and habits tend to hint at the personality of the individual. And I think here you have staffers and aides who are saying that the president is a straight arrow. He's very highly ethical on the golf course, as he is as president. But we also have to kind of take my faith on that because we haven't seen him score a game.
Golf is one of the most popular sports among U.S. presidents. Does Mr. Obama have a chance to rank among the upper echelon of presidential players? You know, he's got 3 more years to practice at least, and maybe 7 more.
Some of the golf pros that I spoke with said that it might take a second term for him to reach the skill level of John F. Kennedy, who was one of the best of the last 18 presidents. 15 of them have golfed, and he was in the upper echelon. So it could require a bit more practice. It just really depends. And I guess we're not going to really know because we're not going to have an opportunity to take a look at him as he improves.
Well, maybe if he gets good enough, eventually he will invite the press along on one of his 18-hole journeys, and then you'll see it.
That's true. I think, though, now that we've been sequestered so long on buses and in food courts while the president golfs, I think we'd really want to see substantial proof. We'd have to be able to film the scorecard, for example.
Elizabeth Williamson's article, Quietly, the President Finds That Golf Is No Slam Dunk, appeared in the Wall Street Journal. You can find a link to that story on our website, onlyagame.org. Elizabeth Williamson joined us from a town hall meeting the president was conducting in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Elizabeth, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, it's been great. Thank you.
Should you wish to navigate the fascinating world of sports radio with opposable thumbs, please do so by visiting onlyagame.org. In the introduction to his new book, Onward Christian Athletes, subtitled Turning Ballparks into Pulpits and Players into Preachers, Tom Crottenmaker writes that football and baseball players who point to the sky after their triumphs, quote, are fruits of a campaign by well-organized, well-financed evangelical sports ministries committed to leveraging sports to reach and change the broader American culture. This may surprise folks who have assumed a certain degree of spontaneity in the celebrations of those athletes. Tom Crottenmaker joins me now from Portland, Oregon, to discuss the book. Welcome to Only a Game.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
You're a journalist who has specialized in writing about religion. What led you to the subject of religion as it has become apparent in sports?
Well, as I was examining the religious and cultural landscape, you see that there have been lots of books and lots of articles about religion and politics in this day and age. But that's only one part of this broader story about religion in our culture. And as someone who's an avid sports fan, I was noticing a lot of religious expression in big-time sports, too. And the journalist in me sensed that there was really something to this story that deserved some close examination and commentary.
You maintain that when some of these ballplayers answer the first post-game question by crediting Jesus, they're part of a campaign. Whose campaign is it?
Well, since World War II, a variety of evangelical sports ministries have started up, most notably Fellowship of Christian Athletes, Athletes in Action. And these organizations have correctly identified big-time sports as a very influential, high-visibility sector of our society. And as they've gotten more organized and made inroads, well, you see it coming out in the way that so many players today have become evangelical Christians, and they're very willing to speak up about their faith any chance they get.
A lot of Major League and Minor League baseball teams now offer something called Baseball Chapel.
That's
right. I hope offer is the right word and not require. But anyway, what is it and how does it work?
Well, as I was saying before, there's a variety of evangelical sports ministries that have risen up. And the ministry that serves professional baseball is Baseball Chapel. They're based in Pennsylvania. And they provide chaplains, Christian chaplains, for all the teams in Major League and Minor League Baseball. This kind of chaplaincy operation is more organized and more uniform in baseball than in the other sports. So these chaplains are placed with each of the teams. They organize Bible studies, chapel services, because they have a hard time making it to church on Sunday for reasons that are obvious. and understandable. So that's part of what they're doing. But they're also there to, frankly, evangelize and to try to leverage the influence and visibility of pro athletes to reach the wider public with their evangelistic message.
In the chapter titled Church at the Ballpark, you write that sometimes what the born-again Christians call sharing, and again I'm using your word, sounds more like what you call, quote, a religious bludgeoning. What did you have in mind with that phrase?
Well, the way the sharing comes out is going to depend greatly on the person who's doing the sharing. A major thrust of evangelical Christianity, as the name would imply, is to share the faith. They get this from teachings in the Bible, the Great Commission and all that. But what is sharing to one person may be proselytizing to another. I mean, let's face it, these are touchy subjects in religiously diverse America.
I think one of the most powerful stories along that line comes when one of the young players asks the chaplain about the player's former girlfriend.
Yeah, Bill, this is something that flared up a few years ago with the Washington Nationals. One of the young ballplayers on the team, this guy named Ryan Church, was talking about a conversation he'd had with the chaplain. And Ryan Church had asked about the fate of his former girlfriend, who was Jewish. And he said, Jewish people, they're going to hell, right? And the chaplain nodded that, yeah, that is what happens. When that came out in the Post, you can imagine the reaction from the Jewish community. They were very upset, and understandably so.
At several points in Onward Christian Athletes, you contend that Baseball Chapel and similar organizations, and I'm quoting again here, help transform numerous lives for the better. What did you have in mind there?
Well, one positive side of this Christian engagement with sports is that many of the Christian athletes are really good citizens. I mean, these are the guys who are good husbands and fathers and teammates. Think of someone like Kurt Warner or Albert Pujols from pro baseball. These guys are good citizens and they're good guys. And you have to believe that their Christian belief is at least a factor in their outstanding moral behavior. And so when I look at what's good about Christianity and pro sports, it's that positive moral influence on the individual behavior of athletes.
On the other hand, you write that the sort of evangelism common in pro and college sports, quote, should raise vexing questions because of the pieces of Jesus left behind. What's left behind when a ballplayer who's hit a game-winning home run attributes his success to his faith and points to the sky?
Well, there's a couple things that come to mind there. One, what about the Christians who were on the losing team? I mean, do people really think that God has something to do with, victories in sports but isn't with the losers? Now, the other thing that you brought to mind for me is the fact that these religious athletes and these Christian ministries so seldom have anything to say about the larger or structural sins, if you will, in big-time sports. You know, the excesses and the abuses, the violence that we see in sports, the greed. And I would like to see these Christian athletes and ministries sort of bring the whole gospel to sports and raise up a prophetic voice that has something to say about these abuses and excesses of big-time sports in our day.
Well, I'm tempted to just play the devil's advocate, so to speak, here for a minute. But what about the possibility that an individual's religious beliefs or lack of same are his or her private concern and that any attempt to proselytize in the workplace is misguided?
Well, I do know a lot of progressive and secular-leaning fans who do not appreciate all the religious expression that we see in sports. I mean, I've seen it so many times. Friends of mine, you know, with the eye rolling and the, oh, come on, when an athlete speaks up about their faith.
I'm talking with Tom Krottenmaker. He's the author of Onward Christian Athletes, and you're listening to Only a Game. What sort of reaction have you had to Onward Christian Athletes, especially from either the athletes who identify with evangelical groups or with organizations like Baseball Chapel or Athletes in Action?
Well, it's been mixed. There has been criticism of the book from some conservative Christians. They really appreciate that these athletes are willing to wear their faith on their sleeve. So they don't appreciate it when they see someone like me, you know, questioning the appropriateness of this, which is one thing I do in the book. On the other hand, Athletes in Action, for example, they say they welcome the opportunity for someone like me, to provide hopefully some constructive criticism and help them figure out how to reinvent the way they go about fulfilling the Great Commission. You'll find in the book that some of these guys question the effectiveness of sports world evangelism today. They talk about the need for a new model of evangelism in our changing culture.
What would that new model be?
They talk about how throwing out these truth grenades, as one guy puts it, just aren't very effective and aren't really appreciated by, secular and progressive America. And they're looking for new ways to connect. One way that I see would be if sports ministry came to be known as the organizations that were looking out for the well-being of athletes. Think about head injuries on football players, for example. Or if they were concerned about the misuse of taxpayer dollars to fund these opulent stadiums, I think that the broader public would really be interested in hearing what these guys had to say. That may be a naive hope that I have, but I think there's really some potential there.
I like some of what you're saying. I like the ideas that such things as head injuries could be addressed, and likewise the ripping off of the public in terms of the building of some of these stadiums. But I worry a little bit about who gets to decide what the appropriate message is, because sometimes the message from some of these groups is homosexuality is a sin, for example.
Well, that is a very legitimate worry. Christianity in sports has generally been a very conservative form of Christianity, conservative theologically and politically.
Tom Krautenmaker is the author of Onward Christian Athletes, Turning Ballparks into Pulpits and Players into Preachers. It's published by Roman and Littlefield, no relation. Tom, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, thank you very much for having me on the program.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And AVFX, Boston-based and serving the nation with audiovisual staging tools at corporate meetings, trade shows, and live events. Location information at AVFX.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Perhaps a cowboy has never been more welcome in Massachusetts than was the one who materialized on Route 91 near Springfield on Monday. That's because when this cowboy, who doesn't wish to be publicly identified, jumped from his truck, it was to help the state police corral two 500-pound heifers who had tied up traffic for miles by wandering around on the highway. The troopers shut down the interstate, and the cowboy, wearing his cowboy hat, coaxed the beefy obstacles back into the trailer from which they had escaped. There is no truth to the rumor that all the motorists shouted yippee-tai-yay as they were cleared to proceed on their way. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the University of Cincinnati Bearcats are victorious on the field and in the oncology ward. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of Tiger Woods. A discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Well, hi, Bill. Is the World Cup draw still going on? Because I really hope that we aren't in the same group as Fredonia or Lilliput.
That at least would not be the group of death. So we'll be all right. Tiger Woods has been mentioned just once or twice in the news this week. You've been our expert on Tiger since 1997 when a profile you wrote for GQ pointed out young Tiger's penchant for rude jokes and fondness for women. What was your reaction to Tiger's latest transgressions?
I have managed to avoid talking about this in a number of different venues, from everything from CNBC to Irish News Talk Radio, but you guys are family. This story has gotten to the point now where it's so icky in so many directions that I almost don't even want to deal with it. It was an open secret around the tour that if anything was going to bring him down, it was going to be this. This was something that his handlers were very nervous about almost from the time when I started following him around back 12 years ago now. And now it's hit the fan. And the more impenetrable you make the cocoon, the more fragile you make it and more vulnerable it is to stuff that exists outside your control. And boy, does this exist outside of his control now.
You have written elsewhere that it has become impossible for the people charged with maintaining that cocoon about which you spoke to do their jobs. Does the sports first billionaire really have to worry about losing sponsorships and popularity?
Popularity is a different thing. Sponsorship, I don't think so. Usually the first instinct for a major American corporation is, as we know, cowardice. So if anybody was going to run away from them, they'd have done it by now. I suspect it may be harder for him to get multi-million dollar endorsements going forward. But as far as American Express, Nike, the royal family of Dubai, and the rest of his current sponsors are concerned, I don't think he has a lot to worry about.
All right. Another week, another NFL concussion story, Charlie. This week, Arizona Cardinals quarterback Kurt Warner admitted that he briefly considered lying to team medics about his concussion symptoms in order to play in last week's game against the Titans. Warner's got a reputation as a very honest guy, so are you surprised by this?
Well, I mean, I'm not surprised by this in that he also has a reputation of being a professional football player,
mm-hmm.
and the culture there demands that you lie about your injuries, unfortunately, including head injuries, which are, you know, as we all know, a little bit harder to see outwardly. And I think that the whole culture of his upbringing, his whole culture of his having developed his personality within this sport would lean him toward lying, and I'm glad he didn't.
Fans of the Oakland Raiders have taken their gripes to a billboard on the freeway near the Oakland Coliseum. They've paid for this message: Mr. Davis, do the right thing. Please hire a GM. Now, addressing Al Davis as Mr. demonstrates a certain level of respect, don't you think?
I think, you know, for all the fun that is made of Oakland fans for being essentially, you know, modern Ostrogoths, I think this was very polite. They're very nice. They're very well-spoken. Of course, you have to remember that this billboard was probably paid for by a guy who paints his bald head silver and wears spiked shoulder pads every Sunday.
All right. You ready to strike the pose?
Oh, already? Hang on.
It's Heisman time.
There it is.
There it is.
Or if you're standing in a mirror.
According to the readers of CBSSports.com, the winner of this year's Heisman Trophy should be Stanford's Toby Gerhart. But since the readers of websites don't actually get to vote on that, who do you think will win?
If I had a vote, it would be Mark Ingram from Alabama. But I think it's going to be Colt McCoy from Texas because it's sort of his turn.
Mark Mangino resigned his coaching position at Kansas on Thursday, although, I don't know, is resigned really the right word given the university's investigation of Coach Mangino's treatment of his players?
I would use the phrase he was encouraged to be removed, but I don't know exactly how you would remove Mark Mangino from anything. Let's say his resignation was gleefully accepted.
Of retiring Florida State football coach Bobby Bowden, the university's president said this week, Bobby Bowden in many ways has become the face of Florida State. It was his sterling personality and character that personified this university. Fair characterization?
Well, I've always thought the face of Florida State was a Seminole Indian, but if it isn't going to be him, I suppose it will be Bobby Bowden. It's kind of weird the way it ended. His career just sort of petered out, but it was pretty plainly time.
The New Jersey Nets this week achieved a distinction that they would rather have avoided. No previous NBA team had ever started a season by losing 18 consecutive games. Are the Nets as bad as their record, or are they worse?
Actually, they're not. They're a pretty decent ball club. You know, I don't know why the fates have dropped upon them an 18-plus game losing streak. I mean, they have some pretty talented players there. It turns out it wasn't the coach, by the way. They fired the coach and kept losing anyway.
That's right.
I think they're a victim of a lot of things. Their ownership's in a little disarray, trying to get the team to move to Brooklyn. They're one of the teams that's dumping salary so as to get into the big free agent market next year. But the team is really, personnel-wise, they're really not that bad.
Allen Iverson, expected to play on Monday night for the 76ers when they host the Denver Nuggets. So, who do you think will cry more when the answer takes the court, Iverson or those fans in Philadelphia?
Oh, I don't know. I think it's very nice that he's coming back and the Philadelphia fans are going to give him a send-off. I sort of agreed with whoever it was that said that his career should not have ended because no team wanted to bring him back. I don't think he's ever going to content himself with being a bench player. I think he'll start grumbling in Philadelphia sooner or later. But if he's going to end anywhere, it's nice that it's there.
But did you see the press conference where he was very, very weepy throughout, talking about coming back to Philadelphia?
He has always been a very interesting person. There are levels to him that most people aren't interested enough to go plumb. But from the start, and I interviewed him when he was a rookie, right before he started in Philadelphia, I always found him a fascinating guy.
In his first official act as head of the Major League Baseball Players Association, Michael Wiener announced on Wednesday that his constituents would like to work harder with fewer days off.
It can't be that, can it?
No, they want more postseason playoff games. They want 7-game division series, and they want fewer off days so that the season does not extend necessarily past Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
It may be one thing on which management and labor can agree. I really hope it doesn't happen because the baseball postseason, to say nothing of the baseball regular season, is already too long.
And finally,
sports!
If you bet that the winner of the World Duck Calling Championship
sports!
Would be a man from Mankato, Minnesota,
sports!
You can start... You can start counting your winnings thanks to a very convincing performance by one Mike Anderson, who apparently surprised even himself.
I don't know how you can be a dark horse in a duck calling contest, but that's what he says he was. And he says he's still getting goosebumps about it.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Quack, quack, quack.
You sounded like a barker outside a strip club. This league mocks female athletes, and I'm insulted by Only a Game's coverage of it. We are left wondering whether next week's program will feature mud wrestling or wet t-shirt contests. These are a few of the responses generated by our story in last week's program about the Lingerie Football League, except for a story we did some time ago about an eating contest. We've never received so much email about an event we've covered. And not all of the mail was negative. Some listeners liked the story, and lots of people visited the website to learn more about lingerie football. We were interested in the story because we felt the reporter who does some work for us in California, Charlie Schroeder, would see the humor and goofiness in the phenomenon and come up with an entertaining feature, which we feel he did. But in retrospect, it seems to be a good thing to have aired that story for another reason. Though it has been an uneven climb, women's sports have made tremendous progress over the past couple of decades. That's evident in the existence of the WNBA and women's pro basketball leagues in Russia and elsewhere, in the increase in scholarship opportunities for women playing basketball, soccer, softball, and various other team sports for women to which, until fairly recently, nobody paid much attention, and in the reemergence of women's pro soccer in the U.S., But Martina Navratilova, Mia Hamm, Cheryl Swoops, Lorena Ochoa, and Jenny Finch notwithstanding, we still live in a culture where cheerleaders in shorts and halter tops are a big part of the NFL and NBA marketing campaigns, and where the organizers at Wimbledon recently acknowledged that they are inclined to assign the more physically attractive female players to prime courts at prime time. The Lingerie Football League is out there. Did we promote it with last week's story? I don't think so. It seems to me we acknowledged it and had some fun with a silly idea and moved on. But perhaps we also suggested that the progress in women's athletics apparent at every level from high school sports to the Olympics and the pro leagues aside, gawking at women wearing not much has not gone away, and neither has the inclination of some to attempt to make money on that phenomenon. The story about lingerie football irritated some, shocked others, and appalled a few as well, but perhaps it also served to suggest the complexity of the context within which the progress in women's team sports has occurred. Not long ago, you couldn't give away tickets to a University of Cincinnati football game. The Bearcats' home field, Nippert Stadium, sat nearly empty on Saturdays in the fall. By this time of the year, UC fans usually talk basketball, not football, but this season is different. With the Bearcats 11-0, ranked 5th in the country, and threatening to crash the BCS bowl party, Nippert Stadium has been selling out. And one of the reasons for success the Bearcats cite is a little boy who stands on the sidelines, a 12-year-old with a nasty scar snaking across his head. From Cincinnati, Only a Game's Keith O'Brien has this story.
On a cold November evening, long after the sun has dipped behind the hills, Mitch Stone sits in the bleachers, awaiting his moment. He is 12 years old, quiet and low-key, his mom says. But as the University of Cincinnati football team finishes its practice, there's Mitch, all 70 pounds of him, wading into a circle of players.
All right, y'all ready? You know how to do it?
Break down!
Bearcat football!
It's a dream for Mitch, really, being here amid the scrum of Bearcat players. He's always been a UC fan, but this moment is truly special to him, he says, given everything he's endured in recent months. It started last winter with headaches, blurry vision, and finally a diagnosis, a tumor the size of a man's fist in Mitch's brain. Doctors at Children's Hospital in Cincinnati removed it within days. It was found to be malignant. And that, said Mitch's mother, Dee Stone, was the most devastating news of all.
Because then I knew it wasn't just a surgery. It was way more than that. Then it was the chemo and the radiation. And, you know, then we had to worry about is the cancer, did they get it all?
Facing months of radiation and chemotherapy, the Stone family knew their son was going to need a lot of help. But they didn't expect any from Dennis Murphy, a man they had never met before. Murphy's daughter Jacqueline was diagnosed with brain cancer in 2004, when she was just 9 years old. Through a friend, Jacqueline, an aspiring lacrosse player, was introduced to members of the Northwestern University women's lacrosse team. And to her father's surprise, the relationship that Jacqueline formed with them actually seemed to help her, especially on the days Jacqueline spent in the hospital undergoing chemotherapy.
One day, Jacqueline and I were sitting up on the ninth floor, and she was getting text messages all day long from the Northwestern women's lacrosse team. All the Wildcats were calling, and the little girl next to her says to her, "Jacqueline, who keeps calling you?" And she says, "Those are my friends who play lacrosse in Chicago." That little girl got called away for her chemo. And Jacqueline turned to me and said, "Dad, you got to get her a team."
Murphy knew his daughter was right. And since 2007, he has helped college and high school teams adopt 162 children with brain cancer. But with a paid staff of just one, the Friends of Jacqueline can't keep pace with the demand. There are more than 1,000 schools now waiting to be connected with a child, Murphy says. But UC football didn't need to wait long. Working with Children's Hospital in Cincinnati, the team found Mitch after just a few weeks. They had him out in July for a team meeting where he was greeted with a standing ovation. And in the moment, Mitch did something that surprised everyone. The boy, bald from the chemo, scarred from the surgery, and forced to wear gloves and a mask to guard against infection, pounded his chest as a football player would.
I thought it was kind of overwhelming to see all those guys clapping and give me a standing ovation. And it made me proud that they're adopting me and accepting me into their family.
Since then, Mitch, when healthy, has been invited to hang out in the locker room before games, stand on the sidelines, and even run out of the tunnel with the rest of the team and onto the field.
You gotta run your fastest or they're gonna trample you or something.
The players began texting him so much that they bought him his own phone. On his birthday in September, they sang to him. Marty Gilliard, one of the top wide receivers in the country, said he considers Mitch to be his little brother and believes they're actually helping him get better.
Because he ain't got to worry about not having no hair. We got people on our team that are bald. You know what I mean? He don't have to worry about having scars. I got scars. Like, I showed him one of my most gruesome scars. I was like, "Little bro, I know I keep seeing you rub your head, man. Don't worry about your scar, bro. We all got scars." And I showed him my scar.
Head coach Brian Kelly, whose wife is a 2-time cancer survivor, said playing alongside Mitch has given players perspective as well as motivation. Players and coaches credit Mitch in part for the season they're having. And just 2 weeks ago, they all got some good news. Mitch's latest MRI shows that he is cancer-free, a result so exciting that Coach Kelly walked across the field one day after practice to ask Mitch about it.
"What's up? Nothing happened, any exciting news or anything this week?"
"Yeah, good news. I got my MRI and it's clean."
"Yeah." "So, you know what that means?"
"What's it mean?"
"You get to run out of the tunnel without anybody having to hold your hand, right? Now you're really fine. So you're on your own now. You got it?"
"Yeah."
"And by the way, you call all the plays on 3rd and 25 or more. You got that?"
"Got it."
"Congratulations, buddy. Good seeing you."
A few days later, UC dismantled the University of Illinois 49-36. While Mitch watched the game with his family in a box high above the field. Due to Mitch's health problems, it was just his 3rd time attending a game this season. And even now, even with the MRI coming back clean, there are few guarantees. Over 1/4 of kids with brain cancer die within 5 years, according to the American Cancer Society. There can be relapses and recurrences. Parents and children often end up living from MRI to MRI. But Mitch refuses to get down. The players won't let him, his mom says. Like the time several weeks back when Mitch had a bad reaction to one of the drugs he was taking and had to be admitted into intensive care.
and they just started praying. And they just really responded and started texting me back. And, you know, one of them left a prayer on my voicemail and just, I mean, they were there. They knew Mitch was in trouble and they came through.
And so Mitch plans to travel with the team for its bowl game, wherever that game might be. He'll be in the UC locker room before kickoff, and he'll run with the Bearcats out of the tunnel. Surely the broadcasters will catch sight of the little boy among all these giant men and mention Mitch's story on the air, and that'll be just fine. But what Mitch really wants is exactly what the football players want. The kid, free of cancer for now, just wants to win. For Only a Game, I'm Keith O'Brien.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Tribou. Our technical director is John Perotti. Our intern is Jeremy Bernfeld, and we had help this week from John Frazee, no relation to Harry, at Palatine Recordings. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our photo galleries, download our weekly podcasts, learn more about the music you hear on our program, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from the 1-18 New Jersey Nets, who gloat about last night's triumphant victory. I didn't think so. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Mini, featuring the 37 miles per gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info. The George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.